Good morning. In a week of competing opinion pieces about the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, one by a candidate for the organization's board says OHA has been wasteful and not transparent. Today we talk with OHA Chair Robert Lindsay about his answer. And former reporter, now consultant, Jan Ten Bergenkate looks at the Kauai campaigns and the races that may result in a shakeup. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Shakespeare's Two Gentlemen of Verona is one of his earliest, and his familiar themes of gender bending and romantic confusion are already in place. Actor Brandon DePaola takes us inside the upcoming Hawaii Mission Houses production. And Kevin McDonald from Kids in the Hall is in town to lead a sketch comedy workshop. He should know.
It's a Friday, August 5th. That's The Conversation. First, this news. Welcome to an Aloha Friday. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. This is The Conversation. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Not just any Friday.
Well, right? You're right about that one. No, it's not just any Aloha Friday. It's also a $5 Friday. And in case you're wondering about that or somehow missed all the run-up to it, it's the day when we ask for new members to join us at $5 a month. You could be a new member, you could be a sustaining member, whatever does it for you, just do it and join us at $5 a month and to be part of your Hawaii Public Radio station. You can call our number 941-3689 or 877-941-3689, or you can go online to hawaiipublicradio.org. And thanks very much.
Sounds like a plan.
Well, it was our plan. We'll see. We've had other $5 Fridays that have been very successful, and it's a way for people to join and not see money as being a barrier to that, but just being part of this really great, wonderful experiment that has been going on for these 35 years almost.
Yeah, that's right. Let's get some phones ringing.
Well, we'll find out more about that as the broadcast continues. But for the moment, we're going to take on more serious issues of money. Now, according to the annual report for the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, its funds and net assets total $622 million. Now, some of it spent and the policies behind the expenses came under fire earlier this week in an opinion piece by Grassroot Institute President Kaylee Akina, a candidate for the agency's board. In it, OHA is said to be wasteful, concerned with its own money-making and not transparent. The piece was answered today in a response from OHA Chair Robert Lindsay, who joins us now by phone. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Aloha.
Aloha, and thank you very much for making some time for us. I want to talk to you about some of the things that came out earlier in the week. First of all, the issue of the co-trusteeship of the Papahānaumokuakea Marine National Monument and why Kaylee Akina says that this is, you know, just a matter of doing something that would put more money into OHA's pockets, which you say categorically isn't true. Why?
Well, you know, the expansion of the monument will not create any revenue for OHA. We currently get no money from the existing monument, and that wouldn't change if there's an expansion. I'd like to say that the proposed expansion would take areas of the ocean already under federal jurisdiction and make it part of the monument. So that means if we become co-trustee, as we are hoping to, we will have a greater say about what happens in the monument.
So you're saying that this is a matter of getting a seat at the table, not money
exactly.
In the pocket.
Exactly, yes.
But while we're talking about money, he also says that OHA wasted $33 million on the effort, to use his word, to impose federal tribal recognition on Native Hawaiians, $33 million that could have done, in his words, wonders to ease homelessness and other issues. How do you answer him when he says that kind of money was a waste?
You know, we did what we needed to do in pursuit of the Apapa Bill. I believe we've spent much less on our efforts to get federal recognition if you tally up all of our costs over the past 20 years. But we feel that it was critical to protect the entitlements that Native Hawaiian programs and services out of Washington, D.C. from the federal level. That's why we spent what we spent, to protect educational and social service programs that bring in millions of dollars for Native Hawaiians annually in health and in educational, as well as housing services.
In your piece this morning that's in Civil Beat, you are pretty upfront. Well, have there been mistakes in the past? Yes, there have. But that you are making the case that this is not what's happening now. As you look back over your shoulder, what do you think the biggest mistake was of say, the past couple of years?
I believe that, we have a great need for a financial sustainability plan. And that is something, it's a priority that we are currently working on.
So
that going forward, we will be better able, in terms of our financial situation, to see the forest from the individual trees.
Specifically, what forest and what trees?
When I talk about the forest, I talk about what we generate in terms of revenue through our investment portfolio, through what we get from the legislature, through what we, and then that's the forest, the big picture. And then the small picture, the trees would be programs that are developed through our strategic plan for education, for health, for housing, culture, for land and water, for economic self-sufficiency. Those are the trees. So, putting all of that together collectively, all of the individual components, I think that will help us do better. We are currently managing our wealth responsibly as far as I can see, but with a financial sustainability plan, we'll be able to structure things so that things will be tighter in terms of our of managing our resources going forward.
And what about aligning the policies behind that or policy decisions behind that? For example, where do you put Mauna Kea in the list of forests and trees?
When it comes to Mauna Kea, I know it's been said that all we care about at OHA is money to be made, and that is not true. What we care about a bit is pono stewardship of Mauna Kea, responsible stewardship. That is what we are looking for in terms of an outcome working with the state of Hawaii as well as our university. Currently, OHA, we get only $15.1 million from the state in terms of ceded land revenue. That's all we are entitled under current state law. Until the law changes, until the governor steps in, until the legislature makes a change in terms of our annual revenue amount, we are capped at $15.1 million.
So what about his charge that OHA will be running out of funds, which
that
he
is,
says according
that
to
is,
an auditor's
that
report?
That is not true. That is not true.
The annual report that you put out and then later the auditor's report of the annual report didn't seem to have any problem with the way the report was written or what you had suggested was happening with those funds. As you look at the forward motion of OHA and the fact that you have a candidate who wants to step on the board who clearly has views that are very opposite, if he should be elected, how would you all be able to work together?
We need to put at the top of our pedestal doing what is best for our people. That should always be first and foremost. We are here to be servant leaders who look to serve the needs of our people. And that's what we need to do. We cannot look at personality issues or the stuff that divides a house. I am a servant leader, Bethann, and I always look to doing what's best for our beneficiaries and looking always to do what's best for the trust.
That said, I mean, certainly you would know best that issues of personality have been very divisive. And
yes. In
trying to go forward, that may not necessarily change. But I want to thank you very much for being with us this morning. Good to talk to you.
Yes, thanks so much, Bethann. You have a nice day.
And you too. Robert Lindsay is chair of OHA's Board of Trustees.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. And in about 2 seconds, it's going to be 8:15. Coming up in the show, Two Gentlemen of Verona brings us the bard in a lighter mood. But first, your quiz.
Umulokai, ulanai, umau, ukaholabe, ohavai.
In just a couple of minutes, we'll hear about a local production of Shakespeare's Two Gentlemen of Verona. So for today's backyard quiz, we're delving into the world of the bard. 2016 marks the 15th year of the annual Hawaii Shakespeare Festival. It began in 2000 with the stated goal of producing all of the plays of William Shakespeare right here in Hawaii. In the process of accomplishing that aspiration, the Hawaii Shakespeare Festival has picked up an official patron of lofty status. This patron is a world-renowned thespian, including many adaptations of Shakespeare's plays, and some might say this actor was the best M. James Bond ever had. If you can be the first caller to name the famous patron of the Hawaii Shakespeare Festival, you'll be today's winner of an HPR t-shirt. Call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer, and we'll tell you a little later in the show.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Straub Clinic and Hospital and Gourmet Events Hawaii.
William Shakespeare is seen as such an imposing artist, it can be easy to forget that he was, before anything else, an entertainer. Much of his popularity in his day came from his ability to write light and witty comedies with plots that were just confusing enough to stay a step ahead of the audience, poking fun at wayward young lovers and inviting the audience to laugh at how foolish we can all be. His comedy skills were on display in the play believed to have been his very first, Two Gentlemen of Verona. Brandon DePaola is Valentine in the Hawaii Mission Houses production, and he's with us this morning. Good morning, Brandon.
Good morning, Chris. It's good to be here.
It's good to have you. When you summarize the plot of this play, it makes you dizzy, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. It's very, very, very hard and fast, if you want to call it that.
Jumping from kind of jumping through its subject matter, switching allegiances, right?
Yes, yes. You're very highlighting all these crazy and outlandish things we do when we're in love.
Is that kind of the main point of what he's going for in this play?
Yes. In the very beginning, Valentine is poking fun at Proteus for, you know, not wanting to see the world. He just wants to stay and be in love with Julia. Mm-hmm. And then the very next time we see Valentine, he's head over heels in love with Sylvia.
And?
And so is Proteus.
So what happens from there?
So by then, Proteus devises this very undermined plot to get Valentine banished from the kingdom, so that way he can pursue to woo Sylvia without any kind of competition.
So two good friends, it's established at the beginning that they're good friends.
Yes.
And yet one really betrays the other.
Yes, yeah, Proteus is very much the villain of this play.
So how do you keep, how do you keep the villain from being too villainous? I mean, you want the audience to like everyone in the production, right?
Yes, and I think it really just comes to part with just the direction and as well as the acting. The young man who's playing Proteus, his name is Nick Jeffs, and he's wonderful. He's very charming, yet we see all those little notions in his mind that I really love this girl, but then I'm also kind of betraying my friend, but I really love this girl, so I think it's okay. Actually, he has this wonderful line at the towards the climax of the end where Sylvia is, you know, pretty much getting on his case for betraying Valentine, and he says, "In love, who respects friend?"
Wow. Which is, that's really kind of it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, is it more difficult to get... I mean, I've often heard this said, that comedy, and it's sort of a truism in theater, that comedy is actually more difficult to put across than tragedy. It's easier to make them cry. Do you think that's true?
Yes, I think that still holds true. Just that notion of being funny is kind of hard. That's why people who do it for a living, my hat goes off to them, because it's not easy being funny.
How do you know if it's working when you're performing in a comedy?
I mean,
obviously people laugh,
right?
Aside from the obvious, yeah.
I think it's also keeping those intentions pure and then just being respectful to the text, and then as well as just getting that feel of, you know, analyzing it and understanding, okay, why is this funny? Okay, now I understand why this is funny, so how can I convey this to the audience in the way that will make them laugh? And a lot of times it's something that's very silly or... a joke that, I get it now. That was funny.
But a lot of times, if your character is meant to be laughed at sometimes, right? For one reason or another, he's being ridiculous. But nobody who's ridiculous knows they're ridiculous, do they?
Right. Yeah, no, they don't. They never see themselves for what they are. And actually, very early in the play, after Valentine has his first encounter with Sylvia, his servant and page, Speed, is sitting there, you know, telling him about all, like, this is how you look at yourself. Like, you know, you're swooning, you're crying like a young man who lost his ABCs, and you walked like, you know, a lion, and you were at loss only when you wanted money. And he says, are all these things perceived in me? Like, this can't be.
That makes me think of another thing that happens in Shakespeare where a retainer of some kind, I'm kind of thinking of Lear's Fool.
Yes,
here,
yeah.
Tells another character what's going on with that character. Is that an accurate comparison, do you think?
Yes, I think very much so. Just the Fool character is just allowed to commentate on how he perceives these other characters acting.
Which gets back to that, you know, one of the amazing things about that whole custom of the time was that lofty personages had people in their lives who said terrible things to them, right?
Yes, and they were able to get away with it.
It's, you know, the all-licensed fool,
yeah.
Right? Well, getting a Shakespeare comedy across to an audience, it also involves having a lot of understanding or perhaps an acceptance of the values of a very different time period.
Yes, very much so. Just understanding that this is how people acted in these earlier times. Very much so at the end where Valentine finally learns about Proteus' betrayal. And after he forgives him, you know, he says, all that was mine and Sylvia, I give to thee. You know, because I love you so much that I'm willing to just bow out of this triangle, yet still acknowledging that he at the end of the day, still kind of see Sylvia as just a thing to be given away.
Which is in part a function of what it was like to be in Elizabethan England at that time.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
Because there, it also links to other plays that are where the treatment of women is somewhat problematical. Obviously, Taming of the Shrew being a glaring example.
Right.
But you have these when you sort of go against when the times of the play go against the times of the audience and the values of the audience. That's a little bit tricky thing to navigate, isn't it?
Yeah, I would say. Because of course, there might be some people coming into the show that really don't understand Shakespeare fully. So it's our job as the actors on stage and with the director to help convey those themes and out of date mindsets to have a better helping understanding of just how things were in this time. And I think we're doing that very well.
Well, it's just, the ultimate message is it's all in fun.
Yeah, it is. Yes.
Yeah, which is, and he can be, Shakespeare's comedies can be a lot of fun, yes, as you're discovering.
Yes. And I think I also want to say that, yes, that this is a comedy, but there really are just those dark moments where, we take these, where this is taken very seriously, where poor Valentine is banished from the Duke's kingdom because he finds out that he was going to, climb her window and woo her that way, and just how ugly and how jealousy just brings out these awful qualities in all of us.
There's always a lot of depth to that work, isn't there?
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming in.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Brandon DiPaolo as Valentine in the Hawaii Mission Houses production of William Shakespeare's Two Gentlemen of Verona, which will be presented the weekends of August 12th and August 19th at the Hawaii Mission Houses historic site on King Street in Honolulu. And details are on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaii Pacific University, joining the Hawaii Farm Bureau for the new Aloha Tower Farmers Market every Friday from 4 to 7 p.m. at the Aloha Tower Marketplace. Grand opening today.
And support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from you. And today you have a chance to be able to support your public radio station because it's $5 Friday. We're looking for 55 first-time members to help sustain the station with a regular monthly gift of $5. And we'd like to thank these listeners who have shown their support today. James Fields called us from Kula. Thank you so much. We also heard from Sylvie Garnero from Curtistown. Thank you. And thanks goes out to Kathleen Flynn from Kailua Kona. You can go online or you can call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Or again, if you go online, that's hawaiipublicradio.org. And thanks. And now while we're talking about money, we're going to take a look at some big money. As you obviously know, in a political campaign, money's raised and money's spent can determine who gets elected. But before a big battle, what can matter most is cash on hand. With a reality check of this week's campaign spending reports for Honolulu's mayoral candidates, Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair joins us. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
So we take a look at what the mayor says he spent. That's a lot of money for the month of July, $500,000.
Right. In fact, just actually 29 days short the full month, but that's how they do it at the Campaign Spending Commission. Kirk Caldwell spent over $500,000, $524,000, to campaign for reelection. And much of that went to advertising and polling. So if you think you've seen a lot about how great Kirk Caldwell is as mayor on the TV and on radio stations, it's heavy saturation. And of course, there's a good reason for that. The mayor is trailing Charles DeJoux by 9 points, and the primary is next Saturday. So the mayor is spending heavily. But having said that, and by the way, he outspent DeJoux in advertising on similar expenses. Peter Carlisle, way back, much less on spending.
But what about those who have raised money, though? Because we were saying that DeJoux outraised him the last time we saw a campaign spending report, and it seems this time, too.
Right, and it's pretty impressive. His campaign is trumpeting exactly that. He raised $225,000, almost $250,000, also in July. That's actually double the combined amount that Carlisle, Peter Carlisle, and Kirk Caldwell raised during that same time. I will just point out, DeJoux only got in the race fairly late. I believe it was in May, whereas Kirk Caldwell obviously has been fundraising practically since he was elected, as is his wont to do that.
Right, so. But that sort of makes how much he made in a very short order all the more stunning. But as we look at the monies that were spent in all of this, too, and who has what cash on hand, that clearly goes to the mayor.
Right, and we'll see what happens. There's still a week to go, and obviously there'll be more ads and running and sign waving and T-shirts and things like that. But the mayor does have a large advantage in terms of what he's got left over. He's got $750,000. We call it cash on hand. Charles DeJoux, just $200,000, less than one-third of that amount. So should the two of them advance to the general election, that's what the polls indicate right now. Anyway, Caldwell will have more money, if you will, in his war chest going forward. But, of course, I'm sure both of them will once again start aggressively fundraising.
So are we going to see the return of the PRP?
I think it's possible. A lot of people have been talking about it. We did look at what PRP, which is the group that's represented by the Hawaii Carpenters, very big construction union. They actually spent $50,000, and they spent it on polling on rails. So one wonders whether we're going to see them play a force in the general election, should it be Caldwell versus DeJoux.
All right. We got to stop there. We got to move on. But we will talk to you on Monday, so have a happy weekend.
You too. Thanks, Beth Ann.
Every day we bring you a reality check with Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair. And now with a look at what's coming out of HPR's news department come next week, Bill Dorman, HPR news director, joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Bethany.
And here we are deep into a political season, 1 week left until the primary.
Yeah, exactly. And so, again, following up on various political angles, next week, again, we've been following, Sherry Bracken's been following the Big Island mayor's race, and we'll have some more profiles and look at some of the issues there. And also Wayne Yoshioka is going to be taking a look at the Republicans. Remember them? In terms of Hawaii, they don't get a lot of attention sometimes. But
they're going to get a little love come next week from Wayne.
Exactly. You know, in the red state, blue state sort of sweepstakes, Hawaii, as you know, very deep blue. Not exactly news to say the Democrats dominate, but the Republicans are trying some things to gin up some excitement and look at growing their membership, and Wayne's going to be taking a closer look at some of that.
You know, we always talk about what it's like to live in a sharing economy. And when people think about rides, they think about things like Uber and Lyft. And clearly after yesterday, that's going to be changing perhaps. But the idea of actually sharing a car with someone is a completely different idea.
Exactly. It sort of takes the sharing economy a step further. But this is the idea, again, as it stands, you're not sharing rides, you're sharing the actual car, sharing the ownership of the car. It's kind of a logical extension in one sense. But the specific idea is that this could be developed in a particular area, and in this case, Kaka'ako, here in Honolulu. There's a researcher at UH that's doing some work on this, starting with a transportation survey. Might give us an idea about how some of this might work. There's been research elsewhere on the general topic. Berkeley has done some work. But the idea of locating this in Kaka'ako, what that would mean, Molly Solomon is going to take a closer look at that.
I'm fascinated by that, and being very careful about who you decide to be in ownership with.
Yeah, as with anything. Yeah, right.
One more thing before you go away. A YouTube channel for Hawaii entertainers.
Yeah, for local musicians. High Sessions is what it's called. It's helped increase music sales and performances, actually, for a lot of local folks. Mike Love, not of the Beach Boys, but locally, his video Permanent Holiday got over 6 million views on this YouTube channel. Overall, more than 27 million people have visited the site. So Noe Tanigawa stopped by in terms of some of the pre-production work on this and taking a closer look at what all is involved, who is involved, and how that's working.
I'll be looking for that one, too. Thanks very much.
You bet.
Talk to you next week. Bill Dorman is HPR's news director. A week from tomorrow, Hawaii holds its primary election. Mail and walk-in voting have already been happening. August 11th is the last day to walk in to vote. And after tomorrow, you won't be able to request a mail-in ballot. Now, over the last weeks, we've looked at key races island to island. And today, we finish with a focus on Kauai. Former Honolulu Advertiser reporter Jan Ten Bruggenkate covered Kauai County for many years. He writes a science blog now and is a communications consultant, and he joins us from his office on Kauai to talk about his take on some of Kauai's races. Good morning. Good to talk to you again.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
First of all, let's take a look at the State House. There are two districts that could be particularly dicey, but one that seems to really epitomize what's been happening on Kauai, where you've got an anti-GMO activist up against an incumbent.
Not an incumbent, but
somebody who was a former councilwoman.
Former councilwoman, yeah. Nadine Nakamura, who is a former member of the county council and a former managing director of the county working under the current mayor. And she's up against Fern Rosensteel, who made her reputation as an activist, anti-GMO, anti-pesticide activist. Most famously, went over to Switzerland to confront Syngenta at its annual stockholder meeting a couple of years ago.
She went, I know Gary Hooser led a whole group of people over there, and she was one of them.
That's correct.
What about the message that sends? Is that really the crux of the argument, the fact that she is an anti-GMO activist and this has been such an important issue?
Interestingly, that has not been the key to that race. Nadine also has some credibility in the sort of anti-GMO environmental world. She was actively working to manage, as opposed to oppose, the proposed Bill 2491 3 years ago, in which it was proposed that the county take over the regulation of pesticides and set buffer zones and so on. So we have two candidates in that race that have strong environmental credentials. So it's not as easy as saying, you know, you vote anti-GMO, you vote one way, you vote pro-GMO, you're voting the other way.
Which is what makes it such an interesting race.
Exactly.
Going to move on now to look at the 15th district. Is this incumbent going to lose his seat?
It's possible. He has, I think, Jimmy Tokioka has been in that seat for about 10 years. He was previously a county council member. Tommy Oi comes in without a big political background, although he has worked as a staffer at the legislature. But Tommy has the support of the police. I'm sorry, the HGEA, which is the big government employees union. And what's not clear is whether Jimmy's longtime credibility and familiarity will be able to be overcome by a strong vote driven by union members.
What has accounted for Jimmy Tokioka's waning popularity?
I'm not sure that he's waning in popularity. Mm-hmm. He has taken some positions that made unions unhappy. As you know, one of them was the Maui Hospital case, in which the union wanted the Maui Hospital to continue to be a government function, and there were a number of forces who argued that the only way to save the hospital system was privatization. So Jimmy was on one side of that battle, and the union was on the other side, and the union supports Tommy. I don't have a good enough sense to know whether that race is swinging one way or the other at this point.
Let's move on to the county council. Only in the interest of time, I want to get through some of this with you. It looks like one of the incumbents is going to have to go from the county council, with Gary Hooser the low vote getter last time. That puts him in a very precarious situation.
It certainly does, and we could actually lose a couple of our council members. There's been an active movement on the island to get what used to be called the silent majority involved in elections. And one of the things that we saw after I mentioned earlier, Bill 2491, the anti-pesticide, anti-GMO bill, after that was rejected in the courts, the public seemed to have begun to favor, you know, the pro-regulation side had a majority in the council 2.5 years ago. They lost the majority, but still had a large plurality in the council after last year, 2 years ago election. And this year, the question is, will they continue to lose favor? In the past couple of years, Mason Chalk, Gary Hooser, and Joanne Yukimura have sort of been, they don't always vote the same way, but they've sort of been the faction that is at least aligned with the sort of anti-GMO, anti-pesticide group, and they, none of them did well in the election 2 years ago, and there's some suggestion that they are similarly challenged this year.
Before we go, which we have to do in about 30 seconds or so, I want to ask you about the deputy prosecutor race. Is incumbent Justin Kohler in any danger?
That's an interesting, yeah, I think he is. Justin was elected to his first term 4 years ago. He's been doing the job. Lisa was one of his deputies. She was also a deputy to the previous prosecutor who Justin defeated. Lisa Aaron, the opponent in this case, has the support of the police union, which is a big deal when you're looking at the prosecuting attorney's office. So that's going to be a tight race. A lot of folks are looking at that, and it's a race that doesn't get decided in the primary. Both candidates go on to the general because it's a nonpartisan race, and under the rules here, at least two candidates for each seat move on to the general if it's nonpartisan.
But so contentious.
So the primary will be kind of an early indication of how that's going to look in the general.
Exactly. Thanks so much. Good to talk to you again, and we'll do it soon.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. For 39 years, Jan ten Bruggenkade wrote for the Honolulu Advertiser covering science and Kauai County. He's covered every Kauai County Council since the mayor-council form of government was created. Now he's a communications consultant. He writes a science blog, RaisingIslands.com, and is the author of several books. He's also an elected member of the Kauai Island Utility Cooperative Board of Directors.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. Most people know that the Queen's Medical Center was founded by Queen Emma. It was originally called Queen's Hospital and created because the Queen saw that her people needed a place to go for medical attention. The surprising part of the story is how she raised the money to fund the hospital. In 1859, Queen Emma and her husband, Kamehameha IV, pledged $500 each toward the hospital, but this was not nearly enough money. So the royals walked about Honolulu, going door to door, asking for money or gifts in kind. In this way, they raised more than $13,000 to initiate the building of the hospital. The Hawaii Community Foundation continues the Queen's legacy in supporting the medical well-being of Hawaii's people by providing grants to medical researchers. In the last 25 years, they facilitated $1.4 million to the Queen's Medical Center, continuing her dream 157 years after she went door-to-door asking for help. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you.
Today in the Backyard Quiz, we ask you to name the patron of the Hawaii Shakespeare Festival. The performer in question is an extremely accomplished actress from Yorkshire, England. She's performed in many of Shakespeare's works, including the female leads in Romeo and Juliet, Macbeth, and Hamlet. She even worked with the Royal Shakespeare Company. Our mystery actress has not limited herself to the stage. She has a distinguished film resume, including an Academy Award nomination. Her connection to Hawaii stems from a friendship with actor and UH Manoa Emeritus Professor Terrence Knapp. While performing in a production of Twelfth Night, Mr. Knapp became friends with leading lady and dame of the British Empire, Judi Dench, who became the official patron of the Hawaii Shakespeare Festival through that connection. Nobody got that today. And at 8:47, that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Nohea Gallery, Kaiser Permanente, and Hastings and Pleadwell, a communication company.
Sketch comedy has crept into our cultural language in recent decades, thanks to innovators like the Chicago's Second City, Saturday Night Live, Monty Python, and the Canadian troupe Kids in the Hall. Its ideas often come through a kind of free association when the performers themselves improvise situations and dialogue without knowing where they're going to end up. Kevin McDonald of Kids in the Hall, who's leading a sketch comedy workshop tomorrow, took us through the process when we got a chance to talk yesterday.
A sketch is born through different ways and methods. My favorite way for a sketch to be born is when you're walking your dog named Summer down the street and you get an idea from Comedy God. And the best way to get that, this only happens one out of 47 ideas.
Uh-huh.
But if you're really lucky and it's a beautiful day, Comedy God sends you an idea that has beginning, middle, and end, some jokes.
Mm-hmm.
Usually what Comedy God sends you is just a line. What if a guy had toasters for hands?
Yeah.
And then your job is to finish walking your dog Summer and then go home. And then you have to move it from sketch. From idea to sketch. So you have to start thinking. A guy had toasters for hands. What is it? Maybe is it a two-person scene? All right, it's a two-person scene. When do we tell the audience the guy has toasters for hands?
Yeah.
I know. We don't know. They're sitting at a table and his hands are hidden, and he's talking a lot about toast and bread. And I'll get some laughs out of that. The audience will think it's about a guy being obsessed with bread. Then a third of the way through the sketch, his friend will say, could you pass me that? And he raises his hand, and there's toaster. It's a toaster. And then that should get a big laugh. And then hopefully my ideas are a little funnier than toaster for hands. But the more I think about it, it's kind of funny. And then I'll have the toast flying out of the toast. And so a sketch is born. Now what the Kitchen Hall used to do and what I teach in this workshop is force ideas. Sometimes we would improvise a few scenes, and the best ones we would say, oh, that's a good sketch. Why don't we work on that? And then we sit down. What did we like about that improv? What was the funny part? That was funny, but that got a laugh only because it was an improv and we knew you were thinking, making it up and talking and thinking at the same time. When the audience comes and sees us a sketch, we won't get that laugh. So how do we make that into a sketch? We would think about it and then we would make it into a sketch. That's more work, but it got a lot of good sketches done. So there are a few ways to make a sketch.
Well, Kevin, if Comedy God gives you 47 ideas and one of them is good,
yes,
you've still got to follow through on the other 46 to find out if they're any good. And the thing where a lot of people go wrong is editing themselves too early in the process, right?
Yeah.
You throw out an idea and say, nah, that's not any good, and you don't develop it. Sometimes what seems like a lame idea in development takes on some legs, and sometimes a good idea falls apart, right?
Absolutely. I've had an idea since 1986 that I don't know how to make a sketch.
Uh-huh.
It's about a guy who's $10 short of being a millionaire. And there's so many ways you can go with that. And there are so many ways when
So every time he gets ready to buy something, he hesitates.
Right.
Because that makes him that much farther
See,
away.
See, I never thought of that. That's good. I thought, maybe he's dressed in a tuxedo begging for money. Or maybe it's the opposite. Maybe he wants to go to the Millionaires Club, but they won't let him because he's $10 short. Yeah. Or maybe the both is something. Yeah, your idea is good. But I think the problem was that just at that time when I thought of it, so many different ways flooded in my head. I got paralyzed by which way is best. So now I even what is it, 30 years later, I will still be like paralyzed by that.
But, you know, it would really haunt you. I mean, you're standing at a bus stop, and here comes the bus, and you think, am I going to be $2 further away from being a man?
That's funny. I'll give you a credit if I ever write the sketch.
Please. Well, let's both get rich, so, right?
The saddest thing is when you every time you think of an idea, you think, or at least speaking for myself, oh, this is my hit single. This will be the sketch that changes the world. It'll be like the Monty Python sketch. The guy that wrote the joke that was so funny people died, and so they used it in World War II. But so when you love your idea so much, when you put it on paper and you start writing and then you look at it later, it's flat and uninspired. It's now a one-dimensional thing. In your head, it's 4D. It's four-dimensional. It can be anything. And so you're always disappointed at first. So as you write and get more professional, you have to learn what's disappointing because it really isn't a good idea and what's disappointing only because you just put it down on paper and it's not the same as your head, but you're going to work through it. Because then the work part happens. Then you got to work and make it as good as it was in your head.
The state of mind that's called for here strikes me as being a balance between loving your idea and being able to criticize it.
Absolutely.
If you love it too much, you're not going to know it's lame.
Absolutely.
And if you criticize it too much, you're not going to get it done.
Absolutely. And that would go for any art form, I would say.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Classical.
I almost said absolutely. See,
I'm saying absolutely a lot. I don't know why.
It's infectious.
I only get 17 absolutelys a day, so I think I'm a 9.
You're approaching your limit.
I have 6 left. I'm sorry.
But, you know, it's the whole – we've come to sort of absorb sketch comedy into our cultural language in the last couple of generations because everybody now, you know, just in ordinary conversation with people, you find yourself doing bits and you find yourself taking off into an idea. So it comes – it's more and more part of our sort of way of looking at things, isn't
it? Yeah, and it's sort of taken off, I think. Sketch comedy has been around forever. As we were discussing earlier, probably vaudeville, probably ancient Greeks. There's probably a great I'm sure there's an Abbott and Costello of ancient Greeks, two guys in togas. I don't know what the Greek equivalent of.
Well, you know, what if women said they weren't going to sleep with men anymore if they went to war?
Right, that's good.
That's a sketch idea.
That is a sketch idea. We should write an ancient Greek show.
That one's been done, I'm afraid.
Oh, right, sorry.
I don't know who owns the copyright. You might not might have an issue there.
I think it's over 100 years old. We're probably okay.
Probably, yeah.
And then the sketch comedy, of course, got popular in TV in the 50s. Sid Caesar, my favorite Ernie Kovacs, so I love Sid Caesar. As you say, Steve Allen, it was a talk show, but he did sketches. Milton Berle, and it got popular, and I think it sort of dwindled a bit. And then sort of took off again in the 70s with Saturday Night Live and SCTV. And, of course, who I think are the Beatles of comedy, Monty Python.
Yeah.
And Monty Python. I always think Monty Python were so weird and they got so popular. How come the kids in the hall, were we just more weirder or was the 70s an easier time? And then I come to this conclusion. Oh, no, Monty Python just a lot better. No, Monty Python are the Beatles of comedy. Kids in the hall are the Duran Duran of comedy. That's what I think.
Well, I wouldn't let yourself be haunted by that. There's just no future in it, you know.
There is, but also like was it the 70s? Because also Steve Martin, he became so popular he could play arenas, and he really was a genius. But he was weird. He did anti-comedy. He did stand-up comedy that was funny, but it also made fun of comedy at the same time. Were people smarter in the 70s? He really took off, and he was sort of doing he was destructing it and constructing it at the same time.
I can promise you, having been there, that people were not smarter in the 70s. I was one of them.
Right. I was there as a kid.
These skills can be, to some degree, acquired in a workshop like the thing you're doing.
Absolutely, right? Yeah. Hopefully, if you're coming to the workshop, that means you're interested enough to acquire the skill. And then there's at least half the class who has the fire. I think doing sketch comedy, doing anything, but the only thing I know is sketch comedy, you've got to have the fire and the skill. And if you have the fire to do it, that means you're going to do it a lot. And if you do it a lot, that means you're going to acquire the skill.
Kevin McDonald will conduct a sketch writing workshop tomorrow all day in the Palikou Theater in the Windward Community College campus with a performance to follow at 7:30 p.m. And you can find out more about it on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Well, we're just about ready to say goodbye, but we want to let you know that all day today, it's a $5 Friday. So if you love the station but always thought that HPR membership wasn't affordable, today you can become a first-time donor to come on board at $5 a month. Now, our goal for this $5 Friday is 55 new sustaining members. We've already heard from 13 folks, 42 to go, and we want to send a big thanks to Kathy Ward from Columbus, Ohio, and Ruth Mizumoto from Kailua, and Paul Schultz of Honolulu for sending in their pledges. They went online to do that. You can do that too at hawaiipublicradio.org, or you can call us and talk to a real live volunteer at 941-3689 or toll free at 877-941-3689. And thank you very much for the support.
It's good to call. You get the personal touch, don't you think, Beth?
Well, for all the people who are sitting over there in the library, they'd like that a lot. That's going to do it for us for this week. Coming next week, U.S. Professor of Nutrition Rachel Novotny talks with us about the dual burden of malnutrition for U.S. Pacific Island jurisdictions.
And a reprise of one of Honolulu Theater for Youth's most popular productions.
You can call our talkback line anytime you like to leave us your comments. That number is 808-792-8217. Please, though, leave us your full name and the city from which you're calling. We need those two things, and we'll be happy to play your comments. Or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation or at BKOZHPR.
You can hear the music that we use on the show, a playlist on our page at HawaiiPublicRadio.org. And you can listen back to today's show as well. Our executive producer is Beth Ann Koslovich.
Lillian Song produces the program. Ryan Finnerty and Russell Subiono are our production assistants. And our summer intern is Paul Marto Pinto.
The Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. Have a great weekend and come back on Monday for more of The Conversation.